QAnon.
What had started in an online forum had crawled out from behind the screen to the seat of power, all with the help of a single letter.
And we're going to win big. You just watch.
Hi, everyone. Luke here. By the end of the Trump era, QAnon had firmly made its way into media discourse surrounding the Republican Party and the wider issue of political extremism online. It had also very visibly made its presence felt offline, playing a pivotal role in the events surrounding January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol. But it wasn't always that way. At one time, not very long ago, the sprawling online conspiracy we now collectively call QAnon was little more than one of many to be percolating in the obscure recesses of the right-wing internet, and filmmaker Cullen Hoback was there from some of the phenomenon's earliest days to witness its emergence and growth. Both of those are chronicled in the director's new film, Q Into the Storm, which debuted on HBO last month and concluded its run the weekend before last, and which, of course, we also discussed in a recent episode of the show. Getting in close to some of the Q-verse's most influential figures, Hoback's portrait is arguably the most thorough treatment of QAnon yet, and an example of a high-stakes creative gamble ultimately paying off. Now, we obviously discussed the series at length in our recent episode, but I just had the opportunity to interview Cullen himself about it, and I'm pleased to share that conversation with you. Enjoy. What most distinguishes Into the Storm from other QAnon documentaries, or so it seems to me, is that you began it so early in the phenomenon's development, which was very much a high risk, and I guess in this case, a high reward gamble. You know, it paid big dividends, at least from a documentary filmmaking point of view, although obviously not from others, given QAnon's influence. But given the ubiquity of QAnon in the media and just in general during the kind of final stretch of the Trump era, it's difficult to conceive of a time when it had yet to penetrate the mainstream or have the influence that it ultimately did. So I guess just to begin, I'm hoping we can maybe travel back in time a bit to the moment in, I guess, 2017, 2018, whenever it was that you conceived and decided to undertake the project. What did QAnon look like in those days? And what inspired you to choose it as a subject, given the multitude of conspiracies that were presumably proliferating in the kind of MAGAverse back then?
Sure, yeah. So I jumped on to this story about a little less than a year into QAnon, and what piqued my interest was actually when Reddit, you know, popular image board site, banned QAnon, and my ears perked up. You know, I was a pretty heavy Reddit user. And I was just wondering, you know, what was an idea that was so dangerous or so pernicious or whatever that it warranted being banned? And, you know, Q had kind of been in my periphery at that point. I hadn't looked that closely at it. I had a sense of what it was. But after the banning, it made me wonder, you know, was this maybe just a sign of things to come? You know, was this direction that the internet was headed? And might banning QAnon actually have the opposite of the intended effect, a kind of Streisand effect? You know, would it actually draw people into Q, make them more curious? You know, the macabre, taboo, you know, these things make draw people to it. And in fact, it drew me to it, right? Here was something that was getting pushed out of pushed off of Reddit, and I said, well, what is this thing? So I was brought into it for sort of that digital rights question initially, because I also had a background in digital rights. I made Terms and Conditions May Apply, which was this expose on the erosion of digital privacy. So, you know, that sort of bigger digital rights question brought me in. And then, of course, the question of who is Q, that mystery was something that I wanted to unravel, because I thought that unraveling it might bring the whole thing to a conclusion, kind of counter speech.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, what did QAnon like look like when you first discovered it? I mean, when it was kind of like a year into QAnon, you know, when it was just sort of a few signs at Trump rallies, like what were the kind of breadcrumbs that you followed, and what were the kinds of, the, you know, who were the kinds of people that you met?
I would say that it's hard to know exactly how much people were fully invested in QAnon at that point in time. I think we were still seeing a lot of those who were one foot in, one foot out. People weren't sort of openly, publicly supporting QAnon in the way we know it now, certainly. You know, you would see some Q signs at rallies. You would see some amount of presence of it. But it wasn't this just titanic force in the culture at that point. And you'd get this from talking with Q's followers, you know, those who had kind of come out as QAnon believers. You know, they hadn't fully, you know, you weren't sure if they'd fully bought in yet to it or not. You know, and so I started out by finding people who I talked to QTubers, you know, the people who are on YouTube who kind of translate Q's message to the masses, sort of the bottom of the information hierarchy in a way. You know, there are, of course, the people who consume the information, or the power hierarchy, I should say. So I started out there. I started out with people who had been Q'd, you know, mentioned in the Q drops. And I just started talking with people kind of at the bottom of, bottom, and sort of worked my way up. You know, when I started out with this question of who is Q, I drafted up, I mean, you see it in the series. I drafted up a list of possible suspects, but rather than chasing down every one of those leads, I just thought it would be more efficient to, I mean, if I could, to try to go to the source, which was the site where Q posts, a place that, you know, it's 8chan was the name of it at the time, but it sort of marketed itself as the edgiest place on the internet, and marketed itself as this kind of dangerous, scary thing, you know, which I think, you know, a lot of that is marketing for them. You know, it is trying to sort of create this image, you know, it's their brand.
Right. And I'm curious, I mean, maybe there's not a clear answer to this question, but, you know, having seen QAnon in its earliest stages, as well as its later one, I mean, for, you know, in the film, obviously in the final episode, you're actually, you know, with Jim Watkins during, you know, in the events kind of leading up to the storming of the Capitol. So you got in on the ground floor. So I'm curious, was there a particular moment when you basically thought, you know, oh shit, this thing's really taken off?
Well, I really wanted to, in the series, sort of chart this transformation that I saw happening where, you know, in the beginning, this thing did start it as a kind of interactive game, and a lot of people treated it like a game. But over time, it became real. It became reality. And we even, in the series, even, you know, start with more gamified music as it moves to music that's actually coming from authentic instrumentation. And that was to sort of reflect this transformation that I felt happened over the course of 3 years of filming it, where it memed itself into reality. You know, this is Q is an example of meme magic. You know, it's this kind of the kind of alchemy of willing something into existence, and I think that's what we saw in the sixth was you know, a lot of people, including those in Trump's inner circle, trying to make the Q narrative real.
So, in many ways, what makes the series is, you know, you yourself getting in so close to, you know, key figures associated with the movement in one way or another, you know, notably Ron and Jim Watkins, and also Frederick Brennan, who is the founder of 8chan, who's obviously since fallen out with the Watkinses, but, you know, also several of the QTubers who you mentioned, and the people who were instrumental in giving, you know, QAnon an audience. So, you know, watching it, I was struck by how talkative, how remarkably talkative in front of your camera so many of these people were, and kind of the level of access that you were able to get. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, many of them are, you know, some of them anyway, are obviously quite unreliable, which I imagine presents some real challenges if you're the filmmaker. So I guess my question is, you know, how exactly were you able to kind of get into rooms with these people, or put another way, why was it that they seemed so keen in many cases to talk to you, you know, given that it was probably perfectly obvious that, you know, you weren't yourself a Q sympathizer. And furthermore, in the case of Frederick Brennan and the Watkinses, you know, throughout much of the narrative of the film, they were actually in conflict. So how did that all that work out?
Right. I mean, great question. So I came at this from a position of neutrality. And I would tell everybody that I was filming with, that I was actually filming with their opposition, that I was trying to create this holistic picture of what was happening, because even back in 2018, you know, I did think at that point that it was probably going to grow in scope and scale. So I would tell people, look, this, what I'm making here is a historical document. And because I cared about the free speech issues as well, sometimes I would have conversations about that. Though I think my interest in that topic probably are greater than an audience's interest. So it's not, you know, it's a driving theme in the series, but it's not what the series is necessarily about. But in order to be able to move between these sides that hate each other, you know, I had to set up some ground rules. So, because you don't know, like you said, they're unreliable narrators. So you don't know if they're using you as a kind of channel for information or disinformation. You know, if Ron and Jim, for instance, are saying, you know, who are the owner operator son of 8chan, now 8kun, you know, if they're telling me, oh, the FBI is going to come and get Red tomorrow, you know, are they being honest, or are they saying something to me that they're hoping I will relay to Fred so he flees the country? So one ground rule I had was minimize harm. Another ground rule I had was, you know, that I just wouldn't share information between the two sides. Unless they were specific about me, you know, doing that. And I would tell them, look, like, I'm going to give the other side the same courtesy that I'm giving you. And then I just did my best to listen in those situations and to just sort of play this, the role of neutral observer, but also everybody knew that I wanted to get to the bottom of who was behind Q. And I think that when you see where the series ends up, you go, well, why would Jim and Ron have been interested in that kind of in sort of letting you into the fold and giving you this kind of access? And I think that their motivations shift over time. You know, I think in the beginning they were just starting to have a falling out with Fred Brennan, the creator of the website where Q posts. And I think they wanted to have their side of the story told. You know, this is before anyone knew who Jim and Ron Watkins were. They weren't really major suspects for Q at the time. The shootings hadn't happened that were tied to 8chan, so hardly anybody even really knew what 8chan was. So I had already been filming with them for months before any of that happened, and they became almost household names. But or certainly the site did. So in the beginning, I think that they wanted to have their side heard. I think that they probably enjoyed trolling me a little bit in the beginning. Screwing around with the journalist is like the gold standard for trolls. And I think that they liked that I had a background in digital rights. They run a maximalist free speech website. So I thought they'd have a lot to say on the subject. Over time, I think their motivations for continuing to participate changed. I think that they thought that my line of questioning the first time I was there would be more focused perhaps on the free speech side and less on Q. I think that maybe they were taken a little bit aback by that. And then the second time they agreed to meet with me, their stories changed significantly. Suddenly they knew a lot less about Q. Which is very suspicious, of course. And then as the years went by, I think especially as we were approaching January 6th and they were really starting to get access to the seat of power in DC, they wanted it documented. They wanted people to know the role they were playing.
And so the series, and I guess, you know, spoiler alert for anyone listening or reading, but, you know, the series ultimately mounts a pretty compelling case as to the actual identity of Q. Do you have a sense given this and just given the series in general, how is all this, how has this been received both by, the person in question and kind of throughout the Q-verse more generally? How's the film being received?
Well, you mean just sort of general audiences and then also Q audiences?
Well, I'm talking here about the Q audience specifically. I mean, how does Ron Watkins feel about this, and how does how does QAnon feel about making it to primetime, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of the QTubers have gone on the attack. Their right. reviews have been kind of funny. the Watkinses publicly have actually, I think that they appreciated the artistic construction of the project, and felt like I, for better or worse, gave them a fair shake. Although they have to, I think, debate the conclusion that I draw at the end as to right. who's behind it for reasons of self-preservation. One of the things that's been fascinating is that I think Anons in particular, you know, people who are old Chan users, not necessarily QAnons, found that the reaction I've heard from them is that the analysis of kind of what goes on in the Chans and the representation of that ecosystem, they felt was pretty representative, like to the point where they're like, well, you know, at least if I had to convey what this thing is that, absorbs so much of my time, you know, you broke down the fundamentals and the mechanics pretty accurately. So that's been intriguing to hear. And I've heard from a number of people now on Twitter, many, many people actually, that and this has been really gratifying to hear that for the first time in a long time, people who have QAnon family members or friends, they've opened up a line of communication again. I've heard this from some people who are QAnon believers as well. So it's kind of working in both directions, and I think that can be attributed to a number of things. This project really aimed to demystify the mechanics of QAnon, show the forces that are behind it. And I think that for those who were following Q and for those who were wondering why they were following Q, it answered a lot of questions. And demystifying it took away a lot of its power. And I think it softened some perspectives and gave people a common language and things to discuss moving forward, as well as to discuss, these shifty characters who were basically trolling the hell out of them. So,
I mean, in terms of how the film's been critically received, I mean, there's been praise from some journalists and researchers who study QAnon, but when I was writing my review, I also noted that at least when the kind of first episodes debuted, there were some negative reviews in a few places. And if I was to sum them up, I would say that the kind of crux of the critique was basically that, you give people involved in QAnon, Q sympathizers, airtime, and some even went so far as to argue that Into the Storm might end up in a way kind of aiding the Q project. I think one review speculated that it might make QAnon look sort of cool and edgy, something like that. I mean, okay. what's your response to those criticisms of kind of your investigative method and the approach you take in the film?
Well, I think that we've seen now that the whole series is out that those concerns were misguided. That proof is in the pudding, right? Like that just hasn't been the reaction at all. It's been a little challenging at first trying to get around it because they sort of set the table, and then like yourself, you might have another critic or someone who's watching and who was like, oh wow, this really broke this whole thing down, and then they'll go and they'll look at the the reviews and be like, wait, or some of these, some of the critical response and be like, wait, this is just totally at odds with, you know, the experience that I just had watching this. You know, I was also perplexed. You know, I expected there to be some amount of pushback because here was this person coming out of the woodworks who none of them really knew. You know, there were a lot of people who had built careers as experts on QAnon now. You know, there's this whole ecosystem that's emerged on the anti-Q side as well. And so to some extent, you know, it was a little tricky because I was jumping into their playground in their minds, even though I had been quietly and working behind the scenes on this for many years. So that was a bit of a challenge. I think part of it as well is that for mainstream outlets, it was just impossible for them to get access to any of these sources. You know, like the people who are featured in this documentary wouldn't have talked to them. And every journal on the planet did try to get a hold of, like, Ron Watkins, for instance, you know? He just refused to talk to them. And I think part of why they agreed to talk to me is that I produced this whole thing independently. You know, HBO came on very late stage. They came on in September of 2020. You know, it was mostly me running around with cameras and audio equipment. And I think that they appreciated that DIY approach. And that's part of what helped me get access as well. So I think that part of it is that, you know, a lot of these outlets had written, they'd sort of picked their angles. They'd written stories about what they thought, you know, what they could write about, which was sort of the fallout of QAnon, which is an important thing to write about, certainly, and the effect that it's having on families and whatnot. But, you know, this project was about something different, It was about breaking it all down and showing the actual forces that were behind it. And I don't think that showing people doing bad things perpetuates them. I think that there's a real, there's incredible importance in the antiseptic of sunlight. There's a lot of historical evidence, certainly, to show that revealing the mechanics of something is one of the best ways to to inspect it for what it is, rather than saying that it's dangerous, look the other way. You know, it's not all that flattering.
Speaking of the forces behind QAnon, I mean, my last question is a little bit abstract, and it's kind of a big one. So I suppose, to some extent, you should feel free to kind of interpret it as you see fit. But you know, your film isolates a particular figure as a potential source for Q's posts, at least over the past few years. But, you know, the actual, center of QAnon, you know, the kind of the main causal force behind it seems like something that's very difficult to pin down. And I guess to be a bit clearer about what I mean, you know, it's possible to identify particular people, particular digital locations, things like that have been involved. But when you view it holistically, the whole thing is such an intricate web of, you know, earnest belief, irony poisoning, online misinformation running amok, nihilism, grift. I mean, you earlier mentioned the way that, you know, in the early stages, it was kind of this role-playing game people were doing, and then it sort of assumed the character of seriousness, like, later. So there, you know, in some ways the thing is just like a continuation and a hodgepodge of sort of existing right-wing conspiracy theories. So there's a lot in the mix here, and you know, QAnon manages to be just as absurd a lot of the time as it is sinister. So I'm wondering, as somebody who spent, you know, years observing it up close, how would you account for the Q phenomenon among, you know, the rank and file supporters and I guess also some of the influencers you talk to? You know, where ultimately did it, as it were, come from, you know, beyond the literal sources that you're talking about in the series? I realize that's a big question.
There's also been a lot of great reporting done on that subject. And actually to that point, a lot of the journalists and researchers who have been covering Q have, I think they've really appreciated the, at least they've mentioned to me that they've Yeah, they've appreciated sort of seeing having a lot of the holes filled, or seeing seeing a lot of what was going on behind the scenes. And I've talked with them at length as well about the many of them about the origins and the nature of belief and what it is that brings QAnons into, like, why they're so drawn to this. And of course, I've talked to QAnons for countless hours. Oftentimes, they would call me in the middle of the night. I think that just to talk. And I found over time that for a lot of them, I was kind of an anchor, you know. They would say maybe like a grounding force. because I think what happens is that the QAnon draws in people, and then they become really absorbed with the worldview, and then it starts to there's an emotional toll and then a social toll. You know, it drives a wedge between friends and family, and then they find themselves rather isolated, turning more and more towards a community of other people who are online. But like, what draws people to QAnon? I think it's a mixture. It's obviously a mixture of things, but QAnon gives people this sense that, like, all of the evils in the world can be summed up in a really easy way. It creates this black and white, heaven and hell, all or nothing mentality. It's a super reductive oversimplification that tries to address things that are really hard to understand. You know, like the evils surrounding the banking crisis aren't easy to understand. I've watched The Big Short 5 times. I still have, still struggle to understand the exact mechanics of what went down there. You know, I go back and, like, I look at the Iraq War and the lie that was told to draw us into that, you know, 3.5, some trillions of dollars spent, God knows how many lives lost, you know, and it was a lie that dragged us into that. You know, and so people start turning away. When you see these kinds of evils happening and you're like, oh, you've got these big institutions, you know, people start turning away from expertise. They start turning away from these institutions, looking to other sources. So I think that's part of it. I think that because, the banality of evil isn't sexy, it's hard to understand. This just kind of repackages it in an easy way to follow. There have to be fissures in American society already for something like this to work. I think that we're kind of lacking a common narrative right now as well. And so people are looking for a story they can believe in. It's one of the oldest stories, right? It's looking for a story that explains the bad things in the world. It's convenient because it allows Q to paint anyone they want as a bad guy. It's complete nonsense most of the time, but it becomes a powerful weapon. So it speaks to that same religious desire too that a lot of people have. I think that religious thinking and the kind of thinking that draws someone into Q are similar. It just takes heaven and hell and it just puts it right here on Earth.
We have to go. We need to move.
Game over.
This Q thing is just exponential growth.
I think people are worried it's going to be used to radicalize more people.
Do you think that is warranted?